Welcome to Compassion Collective. On today's episode of Compassion Collective, we come together to reflect on some ideas we discussed in our recent conversation with Dennis Turch and Laura Silberstein Turch. Welcome.
Welcome back to Compassion Collective. We're so glad you could join us today. Michaela and I are hoping to spend some time today discussing things that really struck us from the episode with Laura and Dennis, what stayed with us since then, and actually introduce folks to a tool that we often turn to practice self-compassion that we felt like was really relevant to the discussion that we had with Laura and Dennis. So welcome, Michaela.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Glad to have everyone back with us.
So I'm curious, actually, with Michaela, what stood out to you?
Yeah, so there was one thing, one piece of our conversation in particular that resonated strongly with me that I'm still thinking about, which I think is this concept of the young parts that we each have within ourselves that form very, very early on. I think a lot of people who do some thinking about this tend to say that a lot of times these parts like emerge in kind of early childhood, I don't know, like 8 or 9. When I think about mine, which I'm sure we'll get into talking about a little bit more specifically, I'm thinking about really early childhood, maybe 5, 6 even. And those parts that we carry on with us into adulthood and have difficulty accepting for whatever reason. And the shame that we feel about those parts that have been around for a long time. And I love, you know, Dennis talked about that boy in him when they were on the trip. And Dennis said something to Laura like, oh, you know, I forget what age, the 8-year-old or something, the young boy Dennis and me would love this right now, you know, and Laura was like, he's here. And then Dennis talked about that feeling very, very tender, very emotional. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've been thinking about this. I've been thinking about different parts of the self, and parts of ourselves that we have a tendency to reject.
Yeah, right. And how do we work with those? How do we allow those to come up? How do we spend some time with them? Sort of allow them to be here? And how do we relate to them? Maybe differently than we have in the past, instead of totally keeping them out of our sort of awareness or a lot of judgments around. Yeah, how can we allow some space for them? How can we relate to them differently?
Yeah, and also thinking too about, I don't know, having some tenderness for how they develop. Like we talk a lot in compassion-focused therapy and CFT about the origins of our shame and self-criticism, right? That stuff doesn't just pop up out of nowhere, but it's ingrained. It's in part how we're socialized. It's in part due to our families of origin and the messages and reactions that we're exposed to starting from day one. And trying to understand, like, how do we fit in? How do we, you know, I don't know, how do we do well? How do we stay a part of the family? How do we be accepted?
Right. How do we belong?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking for myself a little bit about how, and this, I was thinking about this during the episode when we were talking to Dennis and Laura, and I was thinking about, well, I was just stopping myself and thinking like, what are some parts of me that have been around for a really long time, and maybe parts of myself that I judge very harshly and have a really hard time accepting. And I was doing some self-reflection and I was thinking about when I was very little, I had some tendencies to kind of act out aggressively when something was upsetting me, or, you know, when I wasn't feeling right. I remember there was even something, I was probably 6 maybe, and my younger sister was 3, and we actually have a home video of me dumping her out of a wheelbarrow. And like, I watch that home video back and I see myself as like 6-year-old Michaela, and I'm watching myself and I'm like, oh, you wanted to dump her out of that wheelbarrow. Like, you wanted to, you know, show some aggression.
Right. There was a part of you that, yeah.
Yes. And, you know, I'm talking about this lightly right now. There were some other instances too when I was a little kid where there, you know, there was a part of me that wanted to like act out and know my own power, I think. And as I've gotten, you know, as I got into, I don't know, my teenagers and my young adulthood and now my just adulthood, I think I still kind of look back at that. And there's a part of me that's like, what was wrong with you to inflict pain? Like,
so judgment, major judgment.
Yeah. And I think a part of that is because I look at myself, you know, now in my 30s, and I picture myself now dumping a little kid out of a wheelbarrow, or like, you know, and that's never something I would do right now. So I see it through the lens of my adult eyes with a lot of judgment. And that, I think, like, shame boils down to that question of like, what is wrong with me? You know, and I think for a while, this is something that I've thought about and worked through, I think, that shame. But for a while, when I would look back at some of those memories, I think I had that feeling of like, what is wrong with you? But instead of seeing like this tiny little kid who's learning her power and learning right and wrong, and, you know, I was sort of seeing it as like an adult doing these things, which is wrong, you know, and adults do have the cognitive ability to know, like, you don't do that. You don't hurt people. You don't.
Right.
So I think that's a part of myself that for a long time I kind of resented and rejected.
Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing even in you, like, I think part of the function of judgment actually is to distance.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so you can't accept things fully if you're pushing them away, if you're rejecting, if you're distancing. Yeah, and that's like rejecting a part of yourself. And so it sounds like on the one hand, being an adult gave you this added set of judgments, right, that you could have towards this mm-hmm. version of yourself, because you're like, what, who would do that, that's awful, those, you know, kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But being an adult has also kind of growing up and doing more work in terms of self-compassion and things like that has allowed you a framework to say, I can, like, the extent to which I push this away or I come close to it is up to me, and I can have some of that acceptance of that version of myself.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Totally. And I think, like, I'm noticing even now, like, sharing it and talking about it, I'm noticing that familiar sense of shame. And I would even call this, we've talked a little bit about, I think in our first episode, we talked a little bit about internal shame and external shame, right? So this internal shame being like, regardless of who you're with or who you're thinking about, that judgment, that really kind of sense of brokenness or defectiveness or unworthiness that you just feel kind of across situations from within yourself. And then this external shame being really about how you fear others perceive you and view you, the brokenness that you think other people see in you. And I'm noticing that kind of sense of external shame
that you're maybe projecting onto people.
Yeah. Well, a lot of it.
Okay.
Yeah. A lot of, I mean, that's kind of what external shame is. It's all projection, right? I mean, it's what we're seeing. It's assuming what other people see through our own eyes, right? Through our own filter.
Yeah. I would challenge that a little bit, because I think there are people who have had experiences of being shamed, like explicitly that has brought to their attention things that maybe they didn't have shame around.
Totally. But that still is what we carry forward, is still very deeply rooted in our own assumptions that we're making, or, you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Totally.
So as I'm thinking about this external shame piece, I'm noticed, like, I'm just paying attention to, like, where does that come up? Like, where do I feel that? Where does that come up for me in my body? And I think a big place mm-hmm. for me where I feel it is like in my chest cavity.
Yeah.
Where, and my, yeah. maybe my throat too, where I just feel this like tension clenching. And I
right. think for me, what yeah, I'm seeing it in your whole body.
Yeah. You can see me on camera right now. So you can see my body kind of turning in on itself and sort of tensing. And I think, like, for me, then I start to get those very shame-based thoughts of like, you know, if someone listens to this, what are they going to think? Are they going to think, oh my God, Michaela, what a screwed up little kid for, you know, for doing that. And I think that that's the, that is the stuff that we carry forward. Right. And when we do go out on a limb and share those sorts of kind of vulnerable parts of ourselves, you know, it's not without risk or perceived risk, right? It's not without vulnerability. But I think one of the things that I always come back to, and this is a little bit of a non sequitur, but I'll just say this, that I a couple of years ago, I went to a talk and we were talking about shame. And the woman who was speaking said that shame feeds on silence. And I just thought that that was one of the most profound statements that just stuck with me. This idea, you know, that that silence is a breeding ground for shame. And it's actually, it takes some willingness to be open and share, you know, in order to be able to even know what people actually think when they hear that, you know? So like when I'm sharing with you right. and
seeing, to do some reality testing.
Yeah, reality testing, right. Some corrective learning experience. So like when I'm looking at your face right now in this conversation, when I just shared that part of myself, I didn't see you like, you know, look at me with like, you know, eyebrows of like, what the
recoil. Yeah.
Right. And that is some corrective learning. It's like, okay, I can share this here. And it also helps me again, go back to like, you know, maybe this is a really like normal developmental, you know, all kids kind of test their boundaries, other people's boundaries and limits, their aggression, right?
Totally. I appreciate that you bring up that, you know, we always talk about origins of shame when we're talking about a practice, starting a practice of self-compassion or starting to look at shame and self-criticism. For the reason that you're saying of these things become almost like calcified, these experiences of shame and our understanding of ourselves early on. And so just starting to look at those in a new light with a little bit of distance and to start to soften and to offer tenderness there can be a transformative experience. And people tend to have difficulty offering themselves compassion in the current moment. And it can be useful to actually think about a past self in some ways to activate some of this self-compassion. It becomes a little bit more accessible sometimes to look back at a version of yourself or even like a version of someone that you love who maybe you're having difficulty having compassion for, a version of them in a more kind of less defense, less armored, kind of more vulnerable version. And so just starting to play around with thinking about, is there a part of myself that I can offer more compassion towards? Mm-hmm. Is there a part of someone else that I could offer more compassion towards? How can I bring that into my awareness?
Totally. And I think actually what you're saying, I think is so important. It makes me think about in ACT, in acceptance and commitment therapy, we talk about this concept of diffusion, which is all about, it's all about creating space, you know, cultivating openness, creating space, creating some distance from. And I think what we're talking about is very much about like learning to externalize a little bit. So instead of just being like totally enmeshed and entrenched, you know, in this knot, this internal knot of, you know, different parts of ourselves, different reactions to those different parts of ourselves, right? Beginning sometimes to start untangling that a little bit. And I think what you were talking about, sort of imagining someone else in your life who you care deeply for, or it could even be a stranger, like imagining just a person you see on the street who is feeling or experiencing carrying some type of that kind of shame about a part of themselves. Or I think another really interesting exercise, I've done this before and it's pretty powerful, is like looking at a picture of yourself when you were a tiny kid and like thinking about all of the blame that you put on that tiny little person. You know, or even thinking like if you have little kids or if you have nieces or nephews or whatever, just little kids in your life, like looking at those tiny little people and thinking like, would I ever actually blame and punish those kids for these things that I'm punishing myself for? I think is really powerful. Yeah. And sometimes that is an outlet also to begin feeling a little bit more tenderness. You know, and understanding.
That's exactly what I was feeling. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. It's so much, I think, easier to offer warmth towards the parts of ourselves that now we can recognize as so innocent and in the process of developing and having the most beautiful intentions. And sometimes, you know, it's just accepting more of the parts of ourselves that our society maybe deems as unacceptable or things like that. Just offering more warmth and understanding there.
Yeah. And being aware too of all the shoulds that we impose mm-hmm. on ourselves, right? I should be this. I should be that. I shouldn't have done this. I shouldn't, you know, right. I always say to people, like, stop shoulding on yourself. Like, you know, like
right.
being mindful of those shoulds and expectations and rules that we impose on ourselves that make it really hard to leave room for mistakes and being human and growing and, you know, learning from our mistakes.
I was thinking along this should kind of line that, you know, Paul Gilbert, who's the developer of compassion focused therapy, he talks about the fact that so much of our circumstances when we're growing up are outside of our control. Yeah. And I think that recognizing that helps to melt some of the shoulds and the expectations around or judgments that we might have, just recognizing that we were sort of born into the lives that we were born into of no, just we didn't make a decision around that, yeah. right? And so just to reduce, I guess, some sources of shame that recognizing how much control or lack thereof, you know, we had.
Yeah. He has this beautiful, he says, like, it's not your fault, but it is your responsibility, which is also consistent too with Marshall Linehan, other people in DBT, dialectical behavior therapy. They say a very similar thing, like, it's not your fault and it is your responsibility. So it's this sense of, like, what you're saying, all this background and history and context, not your fault, totally out of your control. A lot of it, like, none of us asked for or had any control over, and what we do with it now, where we go with it now, is our responsibility. It's, you know, that part is in our control or in much more of our control. Right. And that's, I think, where compassion and self-compassion come into play. It's like, how do I, you know, interact with this shame now in my life? Mm-hmm. You know, what can I do with it now? How do I, you know, I have the option of continuing to punish myself or blame myself for, you know, things that I don't like or, you know, blame myself for or feel ashamed of, or I also have I have the opportunity to kind of turn toward myself with more tenderness and gentleness and self-compassion, understanding, the same way I would turn to someone else I loved.
Right. And I want to make the point that this is not just a self-focused process where the gains or the benefits of doing self-compassion are just for yourself, right? Like, if you begin to look into and have tenderness towards the parts of yourself that you're rejecting now, I can almost assure you, you're going to have different relationships with other people. You're not going to be enacting things out of the same shame-based kind of story of yourself.
Right.
And so it frees you up to have, I think, more genuine and generous relationships.
I totally agree. And that's something that we actually talk about in our next episode that's coming out with Tori Press, about sort of how that changes can impact and change, affect just our relationships more generally in our lives. Can you also talk about, you had an interesting thought too about going off of this theme of rejecting parts of ourselves. We also reject other people. And other people's experiences. And you had an interesting reflection about this. I wondered if you could share.
Yeah. Well, I think it's something we can all relate to right now. On some level, I think, especially in the US right now, things are so polarized. And so even in the course of one day, you can come across the feeling of rejecting someone else or a whole group of other people, right? And what I loved that Dennis brought up in our last episode was this idea that we are that our current sort of divisive climate relies on this idea that we think of ourselves as very separate from other people, right? That there's an I that we're operating out of, and then there's other people. And this can get to like a very heady concept, but I want to keep it like in a very concrete place of the more that we can try to see our commonalities, see the places of contact where we do connect with other people, the more we can train our brain to think like that and to be looking for those things, because the differences right now are so abundant, they're so clear. We don't need to look anymore, right? Like, we need to actually train our minds and our hearts to be looking for places that we are in common, that we have in common with other people, that we can connect with other folks. I just think that that's so important. And so noticing in ourselves when we are rejecting people, and thinking about how we can extend the same kind of compassion to them.
Yeah. And I think it goes back also to like dehumanizing versus humanizing, right? I think it's really easy when we feel anger at a person or a group of people who hold very different beliefs and engage in different mm-hmm. practices, social or political, you know, whatever. When we have those reactions of like, that's so wrong, like those beliefs are wrong, those actions are wrong, it's really easy, at least for me, I know speaking for myself, I think it can be really easy, you know, and I'm talking especially about people who I feel like their beliefs and practices hurt and harm other people. It can be really easy for me to mm-hmm. then just feel this like, you know, anger and then kind of not see them as human beings.
Totally.
And that's hard. Right. That's a hard thing to work with.
Right. I mean, I can totally relate, and I can't help but think about how that is similar to your reaction of looking back at yourself, like tipping the wheelbarrow over. Right? Mm-hmm. Of like, you are having so much judgment around that, so much rejection of that part of yourself. And I just wonder whether we can bring like similar curiosity to some of these reactions that we're having and rejections that we're engaging in the current day. And I am not an expert on this. I struggle with this every single day. It's just something to become more mindful of, because I don't think that rejection is going to bring us necessarily closer to where we want to be as a society. Yeah. On the other hand, there is a sort of appropriateness of sometimes we do make judgments and say, this is not what I want my society to look like, right? And those are really important. It's not about being so inclusive to the point of not asserting where boundaries should be. So it's a very complex kind of problem we are facing right now.
Yeah. And I think what you just said is really important. It's like, you're right. Because compassion does not negate accountability, right? Like you know, being compassionate does not mean, as you said, like foregoing the boundaries or saying, you know, that something is that is blatantly wrong and harmful, you know, and hurtful to another person or a group of people, saying that that's right, or excusable or justifiable in any way. So I think that's a really very difficult but important thing, is like, how do you maintain that boundary in the sense of like, this is wrong, and also this sense of compassion
for the person,
right? Not for the actions, right? I think like that's
right. Not for the specific maybe thing that's said or the belief. It's just trying to push yourself past wanting to reject the entire person or the entire group of people, right? Pushing yourself to stay in the space of noticing that urge to reject, and thinking, okay, how can I train my brain? How can I stay here? How can I see something in this person that I can connect with? Yeah. And it could be as simple as like some of what maybe they're saying is coming from a really deep sense of fear, or what, you know, whatever, I feel fear, that kind of thing. Starting to really try to connect in any inroad, anywhere that you can, to remind ourselves that we're all human.
Yep. I love that. And what this is reminding me of too is I've recently become more familiar with Dr. Daniel Shapiro's work on negotiation. And one of the things that he talks about in sort of negotiation is the importance of affiliation and appreciation. that those are two enormously important components of effective negotiation. So I'm thinking about, you know, when and negotiation in terms of like conflict resolution and the stuff we're talking about, right? And just that I think those things are in line with what we're talking about is how, even if you vehemently disagree with, you know, someone's beliefs or actions or, you know, a stance that they take, that those two components of affiliation and appreciation are really critical for effective conflict resolution and change. So just interesting to think about, I think, in our, in our current social and political climate. Something I want to reflect on.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's another place where we can start to say, like, we didn't choose this and it's our responsibility. Mm-hmm. Like, none of us chose for all that's going on right now. And it is on a person level, our responsibility to kind of create the world that we, you know, want to, that we want to inhabit, that we want to live in, which is very, I don't know, maybe a little bit, like Pollyanna or tropey, but I think ultimately that it sort of is the path forward.
Yeah. So one of the things that that you and I were thinking about when we were talking about this larger, pardon me, concept of rejection of self and other, and I think this is certainly obviously goes back to shame, to talking about shame, is an exercise that we thought that, that we'd kind of bring people's attention back to, which weaves in all three flows of compassion, which as a reminder to folks is compassion flowing outward to others, receiving compassion from others, and then directing compassion inward to the self, self-compassion, self-compassionate letter writing or compassionate letter writing, which is something that for anyone who is listening and curious to try some of these practices, Susan and I on our website, compassion-collective.com, in the exclusive section, we have some PDFs of writing exercises that walk people through how to cultivate a compassionate voice and change both the content and the tone with which we speak to ourselves, with which we speak to other people. And I know this is an exercise that I have done a lot of practice and work with, and I know it's some of the trainings that you and I have gone to. I find it one of the most powerful exercises, sort of time and time again when I try it. So I think that that's a really helpful one if anyone is interested in trying it out.
The letter writing exercises are just a fantastic opportunity to slow down, to stay with some feelings that you may want to run away from sometimes. No one ever has to see them, right? But it's a way to practice relating to those feelings in a more tender, warm way. And so, yeah, I think it's just can be really fantastic to put pen to paper sometimes, or if you use your notes app and your phone, whatever works for you, to just practice that way of relating to yourself. Or you could do a compassionate letter writing exercise where you're, you know, writing a letter to someone else who you feel like might be struggling. And if it's easier for you to start out practicing with just practicing the compassionate voice, you can start by doing compassionate letter writing exercises. And then once you feel like you've got that kind of tone and content down, you can bring that back to yourself too.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons this is such a cool exercise is because it's so versatile and there are so many different ways to approach it. I think, Suze, what you're talking about in terms of starting sometimes with the flow of compassion toward others, I don't think this is necessarily the case for everyone, but in my experience, it is the case for a lot of people that's an easier flow to start out with. I think a majority of people feel like, you know, they can access the care and concern and warmth and tenderness and compassion they feel for other people in their lives, and sometimes feel more blocked off from directing, you know, that compassion inward to themselves because of things we've talked about on this podcast, like lack of deservingness, perceived unworthiness, shame, self-criticism, all those barriers, and fears, blocks, and resistances. So that can be a really good starting point. And then another interesting kind of approach that we didn't just mention, but could be just a unique and interesting one to try too, is what would it be like to write a letter to yourself from someone in your life who you feel really cares about you and loves you and sees you? What would it be like to embody their voice?
Yeah, right. If you're trying to practice that voice.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And actually, another kind of way of trying this, there are so many different ways. Basically, we're trying to do some different, take some different perspectives, right? And so I had a patient recently who really struggled with the idea of writing a compassionate letter to herself. But when I asked her to think about, you know, if she was someone else, right? Like, let's call her Kate, right? And she's in the same exact situation. Could you write a letter to Kate? Which is like a tiny degree of separation.
Which again, it goes back to what we were just talking about in terms of that diffusion and externalizing a little bit, separating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. But whatever it takes to have the ability to connect with that compassionate voice and stance and spirit, just try that. Whatever feels like that can work, that's a great place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, just for anyone who's sort of like, oh, I've never done this before, you know, where do I even start with this? I think the website does a good job at giving people a sense, like a good walkthrough of the building blocks of how to start. So there's also a worksheet that is specifically just for learning to generate certain statements, you know, that are in line with, you know, suffering or struggle as being just part of the human condition and totally universal. And we also talk on the website in that worksheet about the temporary nature of suffering or of pain, and just what it means to validate, the importance of validation, showing up for yourself or someone else, and asking that question that you and I have come back to in multiple episodes of sort of like, what do I need right now, right? What is support and care look like in a given moment? So something to maybe try out and practice.
Right. And you can start by asking yourself, you can start also by asking yourself, like, what would I like to hear from someone else right now, you know, or what is it that I need right now? Is it reassurance? Is it having company, someone accompany me as I start to feel these things? There's so many ways that this letter can help you to clarify to what it is that would be most helpful, most useful.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you just said also reminded me of, you know, as I've gotten more practice with a self-compassionate letter writing practice, that is something that I feel like I've really gained through the practice, is this feeling, this experience that I can accompany myself, which is a very cool, comforting and unique sort of feeling of like, I actually have that within myself. I have an ability to show up for and accompany myself in moments where I'm struggling, which I think if you had asked me a year ago, I don't think I had, or 2 years ago. So I think, wow. again, that goes back to what we were talking about, the sort of diffusion and externalizing, learning to see this sort of, I don't know, inner wisdom and ability of yourself, regardless of what's going on in any given moment, to kind of come to yourself and sort of say, you know, to meet you where you are and see you.
Just having that was just very empowering.
Very empowering.
Right?
Yeah. Very, very empowering. And the last thing that I'll say too is, you know, something that you, Suze, were reflecting on after this last episode with Dennis and Laura, which totally applies to this practice, which is that like we practice this stuff because of the hard stuff we experience, right? That's the reason we turn to compassion and self-compassion, right? Is because we're experiencing something hard, we're experiencing pain. That's the motivation part of
right. And we practice it because it's right. But we also practice this. We use the word practice in terms of coming back to it over and over and over again because it's difficult to do, not because it's easy, right? Like if you just, you know, sat down at the piano and could suddenly do a beautiful piece by Bach, you wouldn't practice every day, right? So it's the same concept that like it's challenging to relate to yourself in this way because it's maybe not something you're used to, or because you have a feeling that you're not deserving or worthy of this, or whatever the barriers are, the challenges are. And that's why we do it. It's not, you know, we don't say, oh gosh, that's really hard, and so forget it. Right. It's like, oh, that means that I need to keep at this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that goes back to a lot of, you know, a lot of practitioners of CFT will say that we all, this is an innate ability that we all have as human beings, right? Or that the vast majority of human beings naturally have, right? This capacity to be compassionate, this capacity for compassion. And so I think, you know, you and I have talked about this again, exactly. I think you just described exactly and beautifully the purpose of practice, right? But what we're doing is we've talked about this like little muscle, kind of slowly growing this muscle that we already have. It's there. It's a muscle that we have, right? But we're growing it over time. And that we're basically intentionally bringing this stuff more into our awareness and making it more accessible, I think is really the piece of it. So it's not something in the background operating outside of our consciousness, but it's a very conscious part of our way of being in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And it can, I think it can become over time a little bit more automatic in the same way of like when you first drive a car, you have to be super aware of, you know, everything. And then I don't know if you've had this experience where you've actually now been driving and you end up at the place and you're like, how did that, I was totally checked out, you know, in some ways, which is a little bit scary, but it can become more of a reflex, more automatic as that muscle is more built that you're in your everyday life. Something comes up, something brings up a deep sense of shame. You're able to notice it, relate to yourself differently. I mean, it can become more reflexive over time. So that's the good news. It doesn't always have to feel as challenging. And because shame is so challenging, sometimes it will. It will, like, you'll be doing this practice for a long time and it will still, like,
hit you. Wham.
Like, yeah. A ton of bricks. And you're like,
oh boy.
Ooh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's okay too.
Yeah. No, it's okay. And it's also to be expected. It's going to happen.
Right.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us in these reflections. And we're really excited for our next episode, which will be a little bit different. We're going to have a guest, Tori Press, join us, who is not a psychologist, is not, you know, directly in the field, but has had a lot of her own personal experiences with the stuff we're talking about. So we hope you'll tune back in and join us for that.
Thank you all for listening to Compassion Collective. You can visit us on the web at compassion-collective.com. Please also consider donating to our Patreon fund at patreon.com/compassioncollective. We'll see you next time. This episode is brought to you by your hosts, Michaela Swee and Susan Murray, co-founders of Compassion Collective. Audio editing by Kyle Turner. Music by singer-songwriter Michael Shines.